Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this LSE public discussion this evening. My name is Chrysanthi Avgerou. I'm Professor of Information Systems at the Department of Management here at the LSE, and also I'm the Program Director for an MSc program on the Management of Information Systems and Digital Innovation. It's a great honor to welcome this evening our guest, Eric Schmidt, who is the executive chairman of Alphabet. I should say, actually, welcome back, Eric.
Yes, because
it's only a couple of years ago that Eric was on this platform with his co-author of a book on the new digital age, where he was sharing his vision about the new and the future digital age. And of course, he is very well placed to talk about the nature of the digital age and the future. Eric started his career in the 90s with a number of leading roles in major IT companies, I think Novell, Sun Microcomputers, and among them. But most of us know him as the executive who shaped Google, alongside the founders of this giant IT organization, and he has worked over the years to transform it from a Silicon Valley startup to the giant corporation that it is today. It has been responsible for the digital and the business development of the firm, and he has scaled up its infrastructure as well as diversified their products. The most important thing is that as Google grew, it has not lost its innovative culture. And that's amazing. Many companies, when they change from startups to large corporations, lose this capacity. Nowadays, in his role as the executive chairman of Alphabet, which is the parent of Google, as well as a number of other companies pioneering digital innovation in various industries, he advises CEOs of these companies on various issues of policy. So we are grateful that Eric is with us today. And the title of this discussion, as you may have noticed, is From Leo to DeepMind, Britain's computing and pioneers. Now, I guess that most of you know about DeepMind as pioneering nowadays in the field of artificial intelligence. But probably many of you do not know Leo, what Leo was as a pioneer company. So let me tell you a few words about this. Leo stands for Lion's Electronic Office, I think. And it was a computer, the first business computer application that was developed back in 1951 at the Lion's company, which was best known for its chain of tea shops. So very much a user company. And at that time, a number of people managed to develop the first business computer, Leo, which then was adopted by a number of big companies as well as the public sector. So Leo computers became really the pioneers of the computers that gradually came to become commonplace with consecutive waves of innovation in all types of organizations. And the Leo Computers Society, which is the co-organizer of this event tonight, has, as members, former employees of the Leo Computers company, as well as anyone who is interested in the history of the company. And some of them are here with us today, I'm very glad to say. So That's what we are going to do today, and I will start with some questions. But just to kick off the discussion, the conversation will really be with you. So after a couple of questions with the privilege of the chair, I will open the floor to questions from you. Before I sit down and I start the conversation, I must say that those of you who are users of Twitter, you can use, is it here? Yeah. The LSE computer is the hashtag. But please, can you turn your mobile phones to silent so that you do not disrupt the conversation?
You know, I should say something about the LEO architecture. When I was a young graduate student, I studied architectures, and I studied the microcode architecture of the LEO, which was quite impressive at the time. So there's a reason why I'm here, and it's to thank you guys for getting me on my right path at the microcomputer architecture level. So well done. First commercial computer in the world, and something that created a sort of, think about what has been created today from this very innovative team.
Mm-hmm.
It's really remarkable. I do the math about price performance, and the computers that I started with in the early 70s, the iPhone or Android phone that you have, we prefer Android, as you know, has 100 million times more price performance than the IBM mainframes that I used to write assembler on. Give you a sense of it.
Well, some of us were taught by those people. And still, I'm sure
old.
They have things to say. But I was intrigued, Eric, when I watched your lecture at the prestigious MacTaggart series 5 years ago, where you said something, you made some thought-provocative comments about the ability of the UK to foster IT companies. You said, I think, that historically the UK has been good in inventing computers and lots of other things, but not very good in converting the inventions to leading IT companies. So even today we have lots of startups, but they do not grow to become independent large companies by themselves. They are bought, they are acquired by Google and other companies, and they in that way never become leaders on their own right. And you suggested that probably one of the problems for this deficiency of the UK industry is at the education, is that somehow the British education system does not develop the required skills for developing successful IT industries. Now, 5 years is a long time for the IT innovation and the development of industries, but probably not as long for change in education. What is the situation today?
So, if you go back to being an American, British people invented a whole bunch of the science and the math that I've grown up with. And yet, the vast majority of the activity in the last couple of decades has not been done by British engineers. What is the source of this? Well, it turns out we sort of looked at this, and computer science, which is a real science, by the way, was relegated in your educational system to a trade. And it was not seen or valued at the same level. So, for example, the faculty member didn't get the same salaries. They didn't get the same promotions. It wasn't treated in a proper way systemically. Right? Just sort of an error in the system. So we talked about this publicly. And the good news is that your government a few years ago actually changed this to make computer science be a proper, you know, sort of system, both in the equivalent of your high schools as well as in college throughout the country. Problem now is you have a huge shortage of computer science faculty because you didn't do the seed corn of those 20 or 30 years. So Britain is now facing an enormous problem of a lack of skills of the kind of people that you're going to need to build the knowledge economy. Now, if you think about the way Britain is organized, because of the history in math and science, which, again, much of it invented here in this island, you have an enormous tradition of this, And you have an opportunity to become one of the great knowledge-leading countries of the world for the next 100 years, right? So we can talk separately about some of the things that are going on within Google and DeepMind here, but they are beyond world-class. They are uniquely going to change the world, right? So these are little itty-bitty islands on top of a big island, right? We need to expand that. So it means, long story, but we're funding a whole bunch of teacher training programs. We're funding a whole bunch of more things to try to do STEM education, a lot more things about computer science. But I would claim that there is a computer science crisis in the country, and it's a crisis of opportunity, right? In other words, you have the people, right? You have the human capital. You have the business market in front of you. It's a capitalistic country and a good one in that sense. But you're missing these people, and you need to fix this quick, right, in order to take advantage of it.
And when you say to fix them, you mean with training to develop...
Education, right? And it's systemic, right? And it's okay that, you know, new things actually happen in the world. You know, new things get invented and societies change, right? And we all understand this from history. This is the big news of today. Maybe in a decade, the big news will be more things about biology or something like that. But the shortage of the skills, right, within the country to do the kinds of things. You think about the digitization of every industry, right, by British firms and British employees with British shareholders and British profits and British success stories is underway. You have a number of very successful startups in the commerce and shopping area. Right? Those look to me like the sort of the first wave of this. But again, not enough. Right? We need a lot more.
Well, here at the LSE, we are, of course, at the Social Science University. And I wonder what is our role and how do we contribute? Let me start with research. With the current wave of digital innovation, not surprisingly, there is huge interest among social scientists about the opportunities, but also about the challenges of digital innovation, currently and definitely in the future. For example, there is quite a lot of talk about the potential for unemployment as a result of machine learning. We are doing a lot of research for that, and of course Europe and the UK has a critical research tradition in the social sciences. Is there room for collaboration between the industry and us? Can we do anything more than somehow becoming a nuisance to the industry? Can we constructively, for example, develop innovation that will make a better world?
We have no choice. We have to. On the question of social sciences in general, we ran the experiment of having the nerds build the products, and they built great products for themselves, but they didn't really work for normal people. Excuse the term. We ran that experiment. I'm very proud of that experiment, right? But a new generation of people have come in using modern human factors and modern design principles. And they've made systems that don't require spending all afternoon making them work and fiddling with them, right? That's sort of what really happened. So when I started doing this, it took a PhD to make your computer work, right? And today, people take it for granted that they actually work, and they do indeed work well. And the UIs, if you look at the app revolution, is being driven as much by user design, human-centered design, measurement systems, the kinds of things that you'll find in modern social studies of one kind or another. So as graduates of the LSE, I would focus, if you're not a primarily a tech person, try to figure out a way to participate in the upcoming app/AI machine learning economy, because that's where an awful lot of wealth, jobs, impact will be created. And I mean that broadly, right? So the on-demand world, sort of, it's the way our society is changing. With respect to the jobs question, we need to come up with solutions that address the dislocation mm-hmm. that is undoubtedly going to come. We can debate the rate and the impact and the nature of it. And there are plenty of ways of doing that collaboratively and not in a nuisance way. Because I think we all care about these issues. Mm-hmm.
In the past, the disruption of digital innovation was, in a way, eliminated naturally from the creation of new jobs. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there is a threshold where this is not going to just happen and requires interventions and special efforts. Have you got any ideas about this?
So I've heard this many times.
Yes.
And I am not convinced that this time it's different.
Okay.
Right? So when it's happening to you, it feels different. But the fact of the matter is, in a modern economics, there is jobless dislocation, and it's tough, and you have to work on it through social programs and help and so forth and so on. But the fact of the matter is that manufacturing jobs, for example, as a percentage of employment in modern industrial companies has been declining because robots have been replacing those people's jobs. In many cases, those jobs were back-breaking jobs, and humans don't do so well compared to robots in those jobs. The evidence so far in terms of job dislocation in the computer world is that it is replacing some of the repetitive jobs. Right? So these are jobs which humans do, which are completely automatable. Right? And those are important people, and those are important people to help them find another job. My own bias, which is just an opinion because there's no actual facts here, is that if you take somebody who's in one of these mind-crushing, not physically crushing, but mind-crushing jobs where they're just incredibly bored, and you give them tools that make them more effective, they can ultimately get a better job and make more money. I am an optimist with respect to that skill. It's not obvious to me that anything different is going on in the kind of technological dislocation that we're talking about now. There are plenty of examples in the United States. For the last 20 years, we've been having this conversation, and the fact of the matter is the United States is at a point of very low unemployment after 20 years of the tech industry doing all the things that we do. Britain, as I understand, is doing really quite well today with respect to employment. There are issues in the employment today. I'm not saying there aren't, but it's not like there's all sorts of people without jobs running around the country.
We'll keep working on this research and follow on a percentage
basis anyway.
Yeah. And of course that will require retraining. So let me come to the issue of the teaching role of social science universities. In programs like ours, we develop capabilities, we believe, both for the IT industry but also for the user industries. Can we have your thoughts about what are the essential skills? First, for the innovating IT industries, but also for the user industries, particularly in the area of innovation. In the past, lots of IT innovation happened in user organizations, and Leo Computer was a prime example of that. Is there such a role today, or has IT innovation, digital innovation, become such a specialized, demanding area that can only happen in specialized industries?
Well, there are plenty of founders of companies who themselves are not people who are doing the technical work, but they have a technical affinity. I'm reminded of my good friend Craig McCaw, who's a history major at Stanford and obviously a brilliant entrepreneur. So these people show up, right? And because they have a view of the world and the view of an opportunity. So my going in position is that entrepreneurship is a skill that's separate from any particular technology, and it just means you want to take some risks, that you have a vision of something you want to build. You see that something, if it were to occur, would make the world a better place. And every entrepreneur fundamentally organizes and believes that, and that's why they sacrifice so much of their rest of their lives to work so headstrong to make a company happen. We need more entrepreneurs, right? And the government's not such a problem in Britain, but in other countries, governments that don't value entrepreneurs don't understand where the essential innovation comes from. It comes from that sort of cauldron of new ideas, hardworking folks, typically very young, access to risk capital, high-risk capital, and people with crazy ideas. You put that together and you get explosions.
And I suppose you mean not only entrepreneurs for startups, but also within the existing management echelons of...
And one of the hardest things in society is whenever you have a bureaucracy, change within a bureaucracy is almost always impossible because human systems have organized themselves in a way where all of the social checks and balances, financial control and so forth, are balanced. It takes an outside shock. The reason business keeps changing is because there's quarterly pressure and earnings pressure and customers pressure and so forth and so on. So, you know, in an established or large company, it's rare that you see significant change unless it's coming from some external shock.
Thank you very much for these were my questions, but now it's time to open the floor for questions from the audience. I will, I think, take a few questions each time. And please...
Can you actually do the one by one? Because I can't
you
remember.
You prefer that?
I can't remember.
Okay, we can definitely take them one by one. Thank you
I
for this.
I try to listen to them carefully.
Okay. So we don't need... I don't need to take notes. And wait, please, for the roving microphone
to have this
reach
gentleman over
you.
Here.
Yeah? Please tell us your name and affiliation.
I'm an ex-Leo user, Michael Hall. One thing you haven't mentioned relative to British computing is the role of finance. And you talk about startups and people with initiative coming out and developing ideas. But in Britain, once we get to a certain point of success, the market with short horizon no longer sustains the growth. And we have the most classic example being the takeover by a Japanese bank, software bank, of Arm in the last month, where one of our gems, the crown jewels of British computing, is now Japanese. And that is symptomatic, really, of the short-term thinking of the shareholding. What have you to say about that, please?
Well, so first place, thank you for that. A couple comments. SoftBank is not actually a bank.
No.
Yeah. So SoftBank's a partner of ours. I know them very well, and they're a holding company, which thought that Arm was a fantastic asset, which I agree. So that's first comment. I think in general, the 5 years ago, there was a very significant shortage of venture capital in London. And I remember wandering around giving speeches that you should generate more venture capital. And that problem seems to have been addressed. There seems to be sufficient capital sources. Again, about 5 years ago, we created something, the London campus, which is a place for entrepreneurs. When you talk to them, they're all crazy entrepreneurs, but they have venture capitalists to talk to. It seems like the problem is that there's a problem at the next stage, right, past that, where larger sums of money are needed and where the financial system is not as flexible as the American one. We'll call that mezzanine funding or larger company funding. And that strikes me as something for the government to try to help figure out how to fix any regulations that might prevent that. I think you're close to getting it right, but you need to address that financing question. So I agree with your premise of your question.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Ian. I'm a LSE Management Science grad, 2011, Yale, 2010. So I grew up in San Francisco and been starting companies here in London for the past 6 years, so I've got a kind of a feeling for both worlds. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the future of organizational design, and in particular, what you feel is the future of self-management. So Zappos recently has run a very interesting experiment where they've transitioned to holacracy, a world without bosses. And I'm wondering how you see the future of organizational design, given examples like that, and given perhaps with an example of how you might see Google evolving to sort of stay competitive as other organizations become self-managed.
It's interesting that you talk about self-management, because when I came to Google, it felt that way. And what would happen is that we were all in one building, and then there would just be these movements, right? And because the people were so skillful, the tools were so plentiful, and just things would happen. And I remember talking to my colleague Wayne, who had grown up in the previous structure, which is much more hierarchical, and he said, it's like the Borg, it just moves forward. I said, is that really the description? He said, yes, it's just moving, right? And you can feel it. And you come every day and you can feel it moving forward. And I thought, that's an interesting model. The question is that scalable? And all of the evidence is it's not. That it works with teams of a certain size, and that above a certain amount of size, you're going to need some kind of both financial controls as well as planning controls and so forth. What we did is we started with the sort of the unplanned model. So, for example, we had a top 100 list which had 300 things on it. I was in charge of the top 100 list with 300 things on it. And we would debate for hours and so forth, but it worked. So I would answer your question by saying that the best companies are going to be where people don't realize they have a boss, even though they have one. In other words, they feel so empowered. In other words, they're bottoms up in a genuinely empowered and passionate way. But I'm skeptical that large corporations can be run in anything other than the traditional model. We've looked hard, and because of Alphabet and all that, we've looked for all sorts of governance models, and there aren't very many long-term successful ones that don't involve a board of directors, a chief executive officer, very clear financial goals, and a traditional staff.
Let me take a question from the balcony now. Well, the person in the middle. Hopefully we'll be able to take many questions.
Why don't you hand mics to the next person so we can run things a little faster?
Save some time from moving the mic.
That's right. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. My name is Philip. I'm a third-year PhD student at the University of Warwick. So I was wondering, today you outlined some of the initiatives that you think are furthering this change that is enabled by digital technologies. Also reminds me of a lot of the ideas you outline in the book, The New Digital Age. And you contrasted that with the inability of organizations like bureaucracies to drive change and to be innovative. So I was wondering what you would respond to people that are skeptical towards these initiatives that drive digital change are happening inside profit-oriented, private, mostly U.S. American firms.
Well, I think the evidence is that innovation is the key to pretty much everything. If you go back to a couple hundred years of sort of human development, it's all fundamentally transformation because of innovations of one kind or another in healthcare, transportation, power, so forth and so on. So I think the premise is if the critic doesn't like that model, I think the critic is losing that argument. Right? So the question is not do we need it, but how do we achieve it? And in larger companies, the rate of technological change is such that a larger company has to have a plan to at least digitize its services. Right? So I spend all day talking to governments, institutions, universities, and so forth, which have not yet digitized the way they operate. I'll give you my story. So I'm flying commercially from New York, and they decide I'm a terrorist, right? So I've got my bag, and they decide to, you know, put me behind the curtain and so forth and so on. And I'm sort of watching with some humor at this, because I'm obviously not. And I realize that, or at least I hope I'm not. So I realize they have almost no information about me, right? So it turns out that their entire description of their treatment of me consists of my seat number, right? Now, I don't know if that, but it's like, it's really kind of foolish, right? They could have actually learned a lot more about whether I was a danger to society or not. I mean, there are lots and lots of examples where if you just thought a little bit about digitizing the way you interact, right, it would both make things more efficient and more probable. Right.
And yet, when I sit in front of my computer and do ordinary tasks, I get the impression that something somewhere knows a lot about me.
We know far less about you than you think we do. In fact, what one we are doing, just to make you excited, is we are working to make the system more responsive to who you are. This is all with your permission, opt-in, all that kind of stuff. And in fact, there's a new set of products that are coming out that use the Google Assistant. And the Google Assistant tries to anticipate, right, the kind of things you're concerned about. What are you looking for? It tries to take one level deeper than just search. So we are making some progress using the tools and techniques, and again, we do this without a lot of specific knowledge about you, to try to make your life better. Right? You can also choose not to use it. Question to your right, has it?
My name is Yas Santisi. I'm an LSE grad. I also design algorithms with TensorFlow, particularly with image recognition.
Excellent. We should mention for the audience that TensorFlow is a open source library released by Google that has one fantastic user.
But no, it's a great library. I think it's the largest starred project on GitHub. I guess I'm being a bit geeky now. But my question is, when I was at LSE, I studied a bit the history of technology. In terms of I'll just take a contrarian view just to see your perspective. If when certain technologies came out, initially there was a bit of a euphoria, a belief that it'll create a sort of competitive advantage economically, but that's in the short term. In the medium and long term, it didn't really create an advantage. I'll just take the example of electricity with factories. Some factories are like, yes, we got electricity and we can automate these things. So my question is, in the context of, let's say, things like cloud computing being increasingly commodified and margins getting lower and fewer players, my question is just, if someone were to say a contrarian perspective to you and say, well, maybe the grass is not so green and there will only be a few winners with the, technological innovation.
Well, let's. I don't agree with the premise of your question, although we jointly love TensorFlow. So let's use the example of high-volume manufacturing. Right? So high-volume manufacturing has the property margins are lower, products are more standardized, and there's many more of them. Who are the beneficiaries of high-volume manufacturing? Normal consumers. And the primary beneficiary are people in the developing world, in the third world, whose standards of living because of globalization have gone from dirt poor to sort of lower middle class from their perspective. So I think the economics are on my side of this argument, that people in aggregate benefit from these improvements. And I don't think you're going to succeed in making an argument against the benefits of electricity for many, many reasons, or the benefits of electric power or so forth. Now, moving to cloud computing, one of the great questions people are trying to figure out now is productivity, as measured by economists, has not been increasing for the last decade. And yet it feels like it should be. And when I wander through London, it feels like an incredibly productive place. Right? It's more crowded, there's more activity, people are smiling, independent. It feels more productive. So is there a measurement error, which is one possibility, right? And there are a lot of people think that's true. And partly because many of the services are free, or is it that it just takes longer to see the benefits of this? But it seems to me that if you look at the on-demand economy, the fact that everybody is on their smartphones doing things all day, that you are infinitely more engaged in the socio-economic, political sphere that you live in than I was at your age, right? That's got to be a net win, right? Now, if you fundamentally believe that engagement causes people to be unhappy, right, then what you're really doing is arguing that that's a return to the past. And I think most of us, there's all sorts of interesting studies. 97% of people sleep with their smartphones plugged in next to their bed. Right, so we're clear, I'm one of the 3%. I put it in another room. The average number of texts people deal with in a week is, you touch your phone 1,500 times per week. The average teenager has more than 1,000 texts per week. Right, so these are very powerful tools, or at least addictive.
The person in the middle?
Hello, Will Venters. I'm a colleague of Chrysanthi's in the Information Systems Group here. I was just interested in data. I wanted to go back a little bit to the entrepreneurial question around DeepMind, that to be entrepreneurial in things like AI, it isn't about acquiring necessarily the finance or even the algorithms with TensorFlow being released. But is there a concern, given we want an entrepreneurial landscape, that competition is hindered by certain organizations, and we could name a few, that have huge quantities of data that aren't available to other AI startups who may need that in order to prime the algorithms? I just wondered about whether it's in healthcare or search or wherever it is.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think, as a bit of background, the way these algorithms work, and you know this by virtue of your question, is they require an enormous amount of data. And so going back to my earlier comment, many people have suggested that we should use these algorithms to solve problems that bedevil humanity like terrorism. Right? The good news, I guess, is there's not enough data about this. It doesn't occur frequently enough, thank goodness. So what we want is we want things which are repeatable and common. Right? They happen all day. And that's how you train. So the language is you get the data and you train. Technically, what you do to make reinforcement learning work is you actually take all the data, you get a simulator, and you have an objective function, and you run the simulator against various scenarios, you train against the objective function, and some large number of computation cycles later, these models come out, which are magical in terms of what they can do. This is how we won against the Go game. If you're not familiar with Go, it's often thought to be incomputable, it is unsolvable, and we beat the human 4-1, you know, in that, and our computer did. So it seems to me that data is the currency, as you pointed out, but there are lots and lots of data to be had everywhere. In healthcare, most of the healthcare industry is figuring out a way to do anonymized data so it can be used for this. In genetics research, which I'm doing a fair amount of personally, there are these large genetic databases now which are used for research that can be do for this. We did a lot of our initial work at DeepMind using games because we could generate the game data by playing the games on computers. So I think there are ways of doing this.
Yeah, the person behind Will. You should have passed the mic and keep it and pass it to the person behind you.
Hello, good evening. Good evening. My name is Alberto Ligi. I'm with the Novak Djokovic Foundation. And you mentioned a little bit about productivity and stagnation on that front. And I'm curious in terms of what Google or the technology that Google might come with a little bit down the line, how that might contribute not to university students or professionals, but perhaps those very youngest in society, those 0 to 5-year-olds, where brain architecture is developing at a tremendous pace. A lot of the research is indicating that there's so much going on there, and possibly it's a lot that could be done by society. I'm just curious, from Google's angle, whether there's anything in terms of the early childhood education front that might be in your mind.
We have not, as a company, focused on this area for various reasons, but there's a lot of people working on it. I'll give you my best example is the Khan Academy, which is now for preteens. And they had the bright idea of using machine learning to try to back solve which math problems allowed you to do best on the math test. So you know how the math professor gives you all of these things, and it's just a pain in the ass. You have to spend all night working on this problem, and you never know why they're giving them to you. Well, using the same algorithms, you can see which solutions, which literally problems that you solve, are more correlated, if you will, with a high performance on the test, which is presumably correlated with real learning. So if you accept that as a fundamental conclusion, then that should be true for every age group and every activity, whether it's a training or painting or whatever. So we should be able to measure what the human factors world looks like and come back with subtleties. In our systems, which are much more digital in nature, we will have a beautifully tuned system. We'll run these algorithms and we'll come up with insights of how to tune it better. My best example there is we did our data set. We have the best data centers in the world. We have the best engineers in the world. We are the most finely tuned. Our data centers are billions of dollars of hardware. They use lots and lots of power. We care a lot about this, so we have the best people tuning it. And so we unleash these algorithms on these best in the world with our best people, and we improve them by 15%. That's terrible, right? Think about the morale of the best people in the world, right? And then the computer guys in the different group come along and just measuring using these techniques, they improved by 15%, which they immediately then implemented, right, for a 15% improvement, which
in
for us...
In many industries, 15% of improvement is a big thing.
It's like all of the profits. So if you think about energy, right, we have this huge issue with climate change, which, by the way, is real. I have to remind audiences in America of this. I don't think I have to remind British audiences. It's real. It's actually happening, right? It's happening in front of us. We need to do something about it. So maybe you could use these algorithms to improve the energy distribution system, right? And a 15% improvement is how many parts per million in saving extinct planet, delaying extinction? It's a big deal.
Thank you.
Can I have... the person in the Burgundy, isn't it? Yeah.
Hi, my name is Jessica. I'm a master's degree student in management of information systems here at the LSE. And my question concerns the impact of artificial intelligence on jobs. So I was wondering, I think traditionally it was known that technology would only sort of eliminate the jobs that would be easy to automate. But nowadays, I mean, we have AI writing newspaper articles, we have AI writing songs. So I was wondering, what do you think the future of this will be?
I don't think the songs are that good yet. And I don't think the newspaper are. So let's posit that eventually, and by eventually I mean in 100 years, a long time from now, computers will have those abilities in a natural way. Right? I'm making that up. Nobody knows how long. Maybe it's 20 years, maybe it's 100 years, maybe it's 1,000 years. In that case, then maybe we should worry about it. But right now, we're so far from having computers being able to routinely do the things which educated and intellectual-oriented tasks that involve creativity are involved with. So it's pretty clear to me that in the automation list, automating the things that are incredibly repetitive and boring. So I'll use a stereotype of a bureaucrat. I don't know if you have any in Britain, but we certainly have them in the U.S. And the bureaucrats, and his or her job is to sit there and check off boxes. Okay, well, that job's going to get automated for the same reason that when word processing came along, word processing, this is 30 years ago, replaced a whole bunch of jobs that were involved in word processing or in factories and scheduling and those kinds of things. So I worry about those jobs. I don't worry that musicians are going to lose their jobs. I don't worry that newspaper people are going to lose their jobs from automation. I think, if anything, automation will make those jobs more creative, right? Because the best example is, think about a physicist. So let's say I'm an okay physicist, but I'm not as brilliant as the top physicists. I want a leg up. Well, what I want to do is ask the computer to learn all of physics, right? And then be able to ask it some questions that I find interesting and let it figure them out while I'm trying to figure out if I can stitch all those into my theory. Because I'm not smart enough to draw myself. Right? You'd use that if you were a physicist. Right? You'd use it as a chemist. Chemistry involves today using very, very complicated models for how molecules bind and how proteins work and how everything reassembles and so forth. No human can master that, even the smartest, but computers can do that relatively easy. So in service of the researcher, in service of the writer, in service of the musician, I really like that. I think for the next decade plus.
In between the very mundane bureaucratic tasks and the assistance to the creative ones, we hear a lot about the potential of this wave of innovation for the kind of middle-class type of jobs, like legal process processing, legal case processing. Therefore, lawyers might be affected by that in the next decades or so.
In America, I never worry about the lawyers.
You don't?
I'll tell you why. You can be sure that at some point in the future, the computer will be able to do what the current lawyer does well. And in the intervening time between now and then, the current lawyer will come up with some new complicated law that the current computer can't do.
But will the Indians who now have outsourcing contracts for these kind of jobs be able to do the same?
Well, but let's think about, why did we outsource those questions? So let's use a stereotype, and I apologize for the stereotype. You have a legal review, which is relatively routine, doesn't require hugely sophisticated steel. It can be outsourced to another country. Right, that's a job that may very well be replaced, right?
Yeah.
It may very well be.
Yeah. So there may be areas that we need to, because we need to recognize these areas to do something about that before it is too late.
Well, I agree with that, but I'll give you another example. Companies move their back office processing. Initially, they outsourced it, and then they replaced it by modern systems. Now, that costs jobs. Mm. And yet, those people have managed to find other jobs because we're in a situation of high overall employment. So again, economics works.
Let us get more questions. Let's move to the balcony again. The lady in the middle of the first row.
Hi, I'm Eleni Maruli. I'm an LLC alum as well. So my question is more about monetization. So a lot of these technology companies are monetized through advertising.
Yes.
So as we move towards AI, what will the future of advertising look like?
Well, I don't think we're done yet with advertising. And the vast majority of the revenue of Google and Alphabet are advertising related, so we love advertising, so we're clear. We're in the advertising business in that sense. And the reason I say that is that we built our business on our essentially precision of accuracy. It wasn't untargeted, it was targeted advertising. And I'm one of these people who believes that with modern techniques, we can do even better in showing you the right ad at the right place. So I don't worry about that. I think there's lots of gas to go, or whatever metaphor you want there. With respect to the other things, right, the non, if you will, web things and phone things, there'll be all sorts of ways of making money. A general rule that I have is that if you have more than 100 million users, you can find a way to monetize it. Right? So, for example, branding. Right? If you look at, there are plenty of services which have almost no ads, but they make their money by brand advertising of a different kind, because audiences are looking for branding, you know, creating messaging, that kind of stuff. It's a different kind of advertising. If you take a look at healthcare, again, I can't speak for here, but in the American system, there are enormous amount of businesses that provide healthcare analytics, information services. Right? There's money in the system that could easily be diverted, if you will, to more accurate healthcare solutions. People pay for health one way or the other, whether the government pays it as they do here or whether private citizens do it as in the U.S.
Can you pass the mic to the person next to you? Oh, you have already returned it. All right.
I'm Stefan. I'm a master's student here. I'm wondering what you think about the limits of the application of algorithmic systems when it reaches the public sphere. So, for example, in the United States, predictive sentencing, and where the limits for very opaque algorithms are as they reach the public.
In the U.S., just explain what you mean by predictive sentence.
Using a criminal's or a yeah. Criminal's background, where they grew up, right. Who their family is, to then decide that they should get 5 years in prison versus 6 months.
So I much prefer letting judges make those decisions, because the systems that we're describing are not perfect yet. Right? They have false positives, they're trained, they can be trained incorrectly. It's still too new. If I go back to earlier to our conversation about, you know, the great writers and so forth and so on, I'd rather have human judges who have 20 or 30 years of background and experience and judgment, and that's why they're judges for a reason, in the British system even more so. I'd rather have them making those decisions. And I know it'll come to surprise to you all, but I'd rather have our politicians than computerized politicians for the same reason, right? So I would rather have the things that are uniquely human be driven, elected, manipulated, judged by humans for a long time. I think that the computers are very good at the kinds of things that we're talking about here, which are assistive in nature, but defining. So something as fundamental as a sentence, right? That should be a human decision, don't you think? I think most people would agree. Things which are of that consequence, there should be a human process and a human check and balance.
Let's move to next question here to the front.
Hello, I'm John Durham. I'm one of the Leo generation.
But
we've talked about two British companies today. We've talked about Leo, and we've talked about Arm Holdings. Leo made unbelievably huge, did all the hardware, manufactured absolutely everything, and the air conditioning unit wouldn't have fitted on the platform that you're sitting on. I mean, that was the scale of things. Arm Holdings actually produced nothing. It just licensed things. And I'm trying to sort of move, I'm trying to get you to comment on whether you think this is the direction of computing. You, as Google, I hope it's fair to say that you haven't gone out of your way to manufacture product, yet there is this other company out there called Apple, which has. And I would be fascinated to hear your take on the way you think things are going to move. Is it going to move with certain people, tying the hardware to their to their technology, or will it take an Arm Holdings or a Google, or which way?
So the industry has gone through these cycles. After Leo, what happened was a monopoly in the form of IBM emerged in the 70s. And IBM was completely integrated from the standpoint of what we would think of as today semiconductors, disk drives, software, and indeed under great legal pressure, they were forced to adopt new practices, accused of antitrust, all that kind of stuff. During that time, when I was growing up, a new set of models were invented that were much quicker, much more innovative, and indeed led to time sharing and then the personal computer. And the personal computer, even though Microsoft was at the center of it, had thousands of manufacturers of things. And remember, you'd say the same thing about Microsoft, certainly a fine company of that era. So I think the answer is that if you can build the entire system perfectly, right, there are benefits to that kind of vertical integration. But the stuff is so complicated now that no single company, even Apple, can build all of the pieces. In Apple's case, for example, it's widely rumored that their screens come from, like, Samsung, for example. They don't make their own screens. They design their own chips, but they use designs which are a derivative of the ARM design. The software that they use, using Apple as an example, is derivative of Unix, which I worked on 25, 30 years ago, right, through a different path involving Steve and his company called Next, and they use a different language called Objective-C, which is based on C, which was made in the public domain effectively for Bell Labs. So I think even the most centralized of companies are open. Apple is a big partner of ours with respect to search. YouTube runs on top of it. Google Maps runs on top of it. There's all sorts of examples which say it's not quite as integrated as you might think. We chose a different model, which is to work on specific areas and then build ecosystems around them. So in the Android case, which is far larger in scale than Apple, right? As a result, we have lots and lots of hardware partners, including ones which are directly competitive. And last week, we announced products which have been well-reviewed against the Apple iPhone 7. By the way, that's known as better cameras, longer battery life, that I won't turn this into an ad, right? So we're doing a little bit of it, too. So it's more complicated than that. I think you'll see a combination.
We have time only for one more question, I'm afraid. Can we have the gentleman here?
The guy in the back has a mic too. Let's do him.
Hi, my name is Matt Kupus. I work at LSE, and I'm involved with building LSE's first technology transfer office. You mentioned earlier the trends, big data and AI. So, Eric, what in your view is specifically the trends to watch, and also over the next 5 to 10 years, where can the social sciences innovate, and how can we leverage the social science to innovate for the betterment of society?
If you're doing technology transfer, then that's even more important, because it's important that universities understand the role they play in generating this next generation of entrepreneurs, and so you're right at the front lines. It's pretty clear that the last 5 years have been the era of mobile. Right, so think about iPhone, Android, the mobile apps, the app revolution. I can go on and on about the scale, the number of jobs, the impact, but everybody here knows what I'm talking about because you all use it. Right, so the next generation, the thing that happens in the next 5 years, is undoubtedly using machine intelligence to make that world much smarter. So literally the devices and so forth that you're using get a lot smarter. In our work with the NHS, it's a smartphone that the nurse uses. Right, it's not a PC or a Mac, it's a smartphone, right? But that's machine intelligence underneath assisting him or her to be more effective. So my answer is pretty clear, machine learning, machine intelligence. It's important to know, by the way, that here in Britain, we have a very large Android development team in King's Cross, and we have a very large machine learning AI group called Deep Minds, which is one of the crown jewels of this country, right? An enormous achievement. It's something which is very difficult to do in the U.S. and something which you all should be very, very proud of. So with respect to what you all can do, from a social science perspective, coming up with all the ways in which these technologies will affect people, understanding them and measuring them and using these tools in an analytical way is your future. So think about every form of social science can now get enough data to come up with real data as opposed to academic theories about how human societies really work, which is what social sciences is about. And let's have you have the honor of the last question, or the plus one last question.
Hi, My name is John Elms. I'm from Times Higher Education. You mentioned the huge gap in faculty, computer science faculty that the UK has. I just want to know if you can quantify that in some sort of way, and also how far behind are UK universities in having the faculty to train the talent to compete with the US and any other good computer science nations?
I've seen a number of studies. It's in the many, many thousands. So I would order 10,000 to start with.
In terms of faculty members?
In terms of faculty, they're missing obviously more. And I'm sure we can get you more specific numbers. To give you an idea how different it is, the American high-end universities, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, all that, are enormously wealthy with respect to discretionary money, project money, and so forth, compared to the finest universities here in Britain. And that's throughout all of, whether it's LSE, University College London, Oxford, Cambridge, Manchester. I mean, I go through the list. Every one of them, it's like a huge gap. It's not 10%. And that discretionary money means that you're not able to fund graduate students. You're not able to do expeditionary research that's unfunded. And universities in America have enough money floating around that they can take a try. You know, here's a clever idea. Here's something at risk. And I think this is a national shame for countries that aren't doing it. And for you all, because the opportunity in front of you is so large, it's a huge opportunity missed, right? Because you're just about to lead across the entire nation in this. If you just chip some more money in that, get some more computer science people, and run like hell. Sorry. It's literally right in front of you.
It's a huge opportunity for our students here. Absolutely. Let's take the positive note of this.
This, of course, is why I'm here.
Thank you very much for being here.